Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by Look Forward, the podcast from Rathbones on what the future might look like. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. The Prime Minister is in hospital. We don't know if he is going to stay there overnight, but he has not left yet. And it was Dominic Raab who was sent to field questions today at the daily press conference. The de facto deputy said that the public should not be concerned at the Prime Minister's absence because he was still leading. But in the Q&A, it became clear they haven't actually spoken for 2 days. James, what do you think was the main takeaway from the press conference?
I think it's very hard to look beyond the fact that Dominic Raab and Boris Johnson haven't spoken since Saturday. Now, it was a slightly odd choice of words by Dominic Raab, which did leave open that they might be communicating by some other means. You know, they might be, well, you know, WhatsApp or Snapchat or whatever. But it's quite hard as it stands to square the statement of how the government say the country has been run, because Dominic Raab took the kind of key morning coronavirus meeting today in the Prime Minister's absence. If the Prime Minister is running the country from his hospital bed, as Downing Street insists, you would think that Boris Johnson would have spoken to Dominic Raab after that morning meeting to kind of to check on progress on various things. So I think that answer is going to raise eyebrows about who's really holding the fort while the Prime Minister is in hospital and how much is the Prime Minister working from hospital. I thought it was quite telling listening to how they talked about the Prime Minister's health, but no one was talking about his return from hospital. So I think as you say, Katie, I think it's a fairly safe assumption that the Prime Minister will be spending another night in hospital.
Fraser, is this situation sustainable? Clearly today, and if you look at the questions in the Q&A, a lot of them focused on how can Boris Johnson be in hospital and not and say he's still leading the country. And it seems as though the fact that Dominic Raab is the one standing in for Boris Johnson in the morning meeting, yet hasn't seemingly spoke to him, though, as we say, there could be some other form of communication, it just didn't come up. That's just going to intensify the pressure over the current arrangement, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. You get the rather clear impression now that there is confusion over who governs when the Prime Minister doesn't. But Dominic Raab is supposed to, but number 10 isn't so comfortable with that relationship, that Boris and Raab are actually speaking to each other on Sunday or indeed today. Now, we were told earlier that Boris's red box is going off to his hospital bed, so it's not as if he's incapacitated, certainly able to have a phone call with the guy who's supposedly running the country. So this suggests either that Boris is trying to govern through his proxies in number 10 right now and dealing with them rather than dealing with Dominic Raab, or there's no one person really in charge. I'm beginning to put my money on the latter right now, actually, because we've had another day of quite alarming disclosures. I mean, first of all, you know, we'd heard a few days ago that the antigen tests to see if people have got COVID are way behind the government schedule. Now we hear that the antibody tests to find out who has had it are also at least a month away. Now, these are the tests which Professor Neil Ferguson from Imperial College was telling us were days away recently. So that is quite a major setback, actually, because a lot of people had been putting their faith in these antibody tests to finally solve the mystery of how many people have got COVID in Britain. If we're at least a month away because we haven't managed to get the tech right, then that really is quite alarming. It's not beyond the wit of man to make proper antigen tests. If you look at Stanford University, they've actually got 15,000 antigen tests, which they bought from China a few days ago. They did the fieldwork last week. They're expecting results next week. If a university campus can get these antigen tests up and running, I don't see why the British government can't. So for me, it was another day of quite alarming disclosures about the ability to try to get a grip of the response to this crisis.
James, Dominic Raab didn't seem too keen to talk at length about his contact or lack thereof with Boris Johnson, but he was also rather tight-lipped when it came to an exit strategy. He suggested that the focus right now was on protecting the NHS, on safety and suppression strategy the government's conducting. Is this tenable?
So the argument in government is, if you start talking about an exit strategy from these measures now, you will lead to people being less inclined to obey the social distancing rules because they will think they're going to come to an end. I think that that doesn't take into sufficient account that business needs some clarity about when this might end or not. I think one of the dangers right now is if this situation is going to go on for ages, I think quite a few business owners will simply close their business down and wait until the economy comes back before trying to start something else up. If that happens, the scarring on the economy will be greater, and the economic recovery will be kind of move from the government's hope of it being a V to more being like an L. And I think that is the danger. If you don't give people any sense of when this is going to end, it saps business confidence. I also think in terms of getting people to observe social distancing rules, I think in some ways, if people know that it isn't going to go on forever, it might actually be easier to get them to follow it. But to come back to what Fraser was saying, I think one of the problems at the moment is lots of the ways you might get out of this lockdown, the medical ways out of this lockdown, they're just not coming at speed. Now, in some ways, we have to be realistic about this is a new virus, but the antibody tests, we don't have one that works yet, so we can't yet know whether, in crude terms, Imperial or Oxford are right about how many people have had it. Because obviously, if over half the population has already had this disease, then that has big policy ramifications. A vaccine still seems to be a way away. Some way of treating people so that they don't end up needing to having to go on a ventilator, again, seems a way away. So I think that is difficult. I think one big thing to watch today is that Austria has announced plans to end its own lockdown. Now, Austria and the UK are obviously not the same, but I think if you see that Austria manages to lift its lockdown without getting a second wave of infections, at the moment the public is in favour of the lockdown, and if anything seems to be in favour of a slightly tougher lockdown. But I think if Austria manages to get out of the lockdown at the end of this month without a second wave of infections, you'll hear people beginning to say, if they can do it, why can't we?
Fraser, the chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, did seem to hint in his answers today that when it comes to ending the lockdown, there are clearly lots of factors, but it isn't just about the number of coronavirus cases and the NHS. He said that you had to look at the general socioeconomic impact and also patients who are missing out on treatment potentially because of coronavirus. So it could be potentially, surely, even without a antibody test, which we're now expecting not for some time, the government could eventually come to the conclusion that it just cannot keep lockdown indefinitely for those reasons.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing a shift in the language. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, there wasn't much talk about the consequences of lockdown. The overall opinion was, okay, here's Imperial College with a model. It shows that the NHS is going to be inundated and overwhelmed with COVID cases. So let's do a lockdown and let's build capacity. Now we hear a very different tone from Chris Whitty, who was actually asked in the press conference if he can give numbers, roughly what proportion of intensive care unit beds are being used, how much headroom has he got. I was rather disappointed that he didn't answer that question, which is a shame because I think people do deserve to know. I mean, in Sweden, for example, the daily press conference, people ask this all the time, and the Swedes make a point of telling people there, because the country deserves to know just how close the health service is to capacity. The answer in Sweden is that it's about a quarter of the intensive care beds are used. They expect that to go up. We don't know this figure in Britain. The government doesn't share it with us. And I think that will have to change. I think the government will have to be a bit more transparent. Because if there is headroom, and Chris Whitty for the first time sounded quite relaxed about the notion of them not being overwhelmed. I mean, after all, they've got the NHS Nightingale Centre, they've got new centres being built in Manchester and Birmingham and Cardiff. So it does seem as if the NHS can cope. So now he's allowing himself to talk about those whose health is being impacted by the way that the NHS is in crisis mode. We know that there will be people right now who, for example, will feel a lump but won't get it checked out for possible cancer because they think the health service is in danger. That will, down the road, lead to a loss of lives and a loss of public health. So there are two sides to the health equation. Yes, you can help COVID patients, but in doing so, you displace and a lot of healthcare. You deprive a lot of people who need it, so mental health patients, for example, of the care that they need. And at some point, you've got to do the sums and to do the balance. So I hope that sooner rather than later, Chris Whitty will start to let us know where that balance lies.
And finally, James, what are the rest of the week? We know there's not going to be cabinet tomorrow. Do you think that's anything to do with the fact that Boris Johnson is absent, in some ways at least, or is it just that we are now in recess and the focus and where the real action is ultimately the morning meeting and the subcommittees on the coronavirus response?
Yeah, look, we are in recess, so the precedent doesn't demand that there be a cabinet. I think that Boris Johnson's absence obviously complicates things. I think Number 10 are very touchy about things that confirm almost the Prime Minister's absence. And, you know, I think it would be a safe assumption that he would not be chairing that cabinet meeting from a kind of Zoom in St Thomas's Hospital. So I think they're not keen on that. I also think that in some way, as you say, Katie, and as you've written, cabinet isn't the real fulcrum of events in responding to this crisis right now. I think that one thing we are going to see, though, which is the big question, is does Easter Sunday at the end of this week, is that the beginning of the peak, as government sources seem to expect? And then, you know, how long does that go on for, and how quickly do we begin to see a decline in the number of daily deaths? Because I think, frankly, all this talk about coming out of a lockdown, I don't mean there's going to be any public appetite for that until there's a clear sign that there's a turn in the numbers. So I think that's what we kind of wait to see.
And finally, Keir Starmer has been putting the finishing touches to his shadow cabinet. On top of the most senior appointments yesterday, which saw Lisa Nandy appointed foreign secretary and Annalise Dodds as shadow chancellor, we have had some more junior appointments today, and Ed Miliband is back. James, what does that mean in terms of Ed Miliband's appointment, and what is the general flavour of the shadow cabinet Keir Starmer has compiled?
So I think Keir Starmer is trying to create a shadow cabinet in his own image. So it's kind of competence and unity. So if you look at the big appointments announced last night, Annalise Dodds, Rachel Reeves, next Thomas Symonds, these are all people designed to look not associated in particularly hard of any particular faction within the Labour Party, and also people kind of regarded as being a kind of across the detail, as he is. So I think you see him trying to create a shadow cabinet that emphasises those strengths of his. I think Ed Miliband's return is interesting. There's always a kind of element of a non-electoral milestone, which is when you get a former leader to come back into your shadow cabinet, it suggests a kind of seriousness about power. You know, when David Cameron got William Hague to return to the Tory shadow cabinet in 2005, it was a kind of symbol that the Tories, you know, might actually get into power again. And I think that Keir Starmer will be hoping that kind of Ed Miliband in that job sends out a similar message. And I think you also see they're very keen to present themselves as a responsible opposition, you know, trying to be constructive with the government on coronavirus. But normally the appointment of shadow cabinet is a kind of big moment for a new leader, whereas obviously for Keir Starmer it has been completely overshadowed today by coronavirus and the news about the Prime Minister's health.
I think Ed Miliband's a rare example of a party leader who has actually enhanced his reputation since leaving the job. He sidestepped the whole Corbynite debacle, and he had quite a popular podcast, and he actually has been proven right on quite a lot of issues. He was mocked in 2015 for saying that he lost the election but won the argument, but then he saw Theresa May in 2017 raid a whole bunch of his policies for her manifesto. I remember when Theresa May ran in 2017, we in The Spectator did a front cover of her next to Ed Miliband's headstone, and such was the intellectual debt she owed him. So I think after all that, he kind of does deserve a bit of a comeback. And it's also strange to say that the Only 3 weeks ago, the Tories would have thought it was almost impossible to imagine that they would be worried about what a Labour front bench would look like. But the events of the last 3 or 4 weeks have certainly called into question the Conservatives' ability to handle a crisis. I mean, nobody handles these things brilliantly, but right now, it's not impossible, as James says in his brilliant political column this week, to envisage circumstances where the Conservatives emerge quite badly from handling not so much the coronavirus, but what's likely to follow. If they can't get the economy back up and running, if they don't embrace pro-growth policies, there's going to be economic aftershock that will make the next election quite tough for the Tories. So I think that Keir Starmer and his Milibandite shadow cabinet really do have all to play for.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And if you would like to find out more about some members of Keir Starmer's new shadow cabinet, Lisa Nandy is shadow foreign secretary, Emily Thornberry is shadow international trade secretary, and both recently appeared on Women with Balls, where I interviewed them. And you can find all the podcasts, if you would like to listen to that, at www.spectator.co.uk/balls.
Coffeehouse Shots is sponsored by the Rathbones Look Forward podcast. Join the world's leading thinkers, writers, and scientists discussing the future of our ever-changing world. In the latest episode, historian Tom Holland talks to broadcaster Andrea Catherwood on the future of morality. Find out more at rathboneslookforward.com.